This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Thursday, August 25th, 2022. I'm Caleb Brown. Debt continues to pile up in the U.S., and under current projections, it's probably trillion-dollar deficits as far as the eye can see. Romina Bacci is the Cato Institute's freshly minted director of budget and entitlement policy. She's looked at the numbers and wants to remind us that historically there are just a few examples of countries bouncing back from this level of debt. The Biden administration championed and Congress passed a piece of legislation aimed at, or at least according to the title of the legislation, was aimed at bringing down inflation. But of course, it's a massive spending bill, and it's not really clear that this piece of legislation will do much to reduce inflation, but it is a massive spending bill. And so maybe it would be helpful to understand better this relationship between government spending, which is a large fraction of total GDP, and the inflation that we are experiencing right now.
Yeah. So what happens when government spends money? It competes with resources, with the private sector. And it depends on how many of those resources are available. And if government ends up consuming or redirecting a lot of those resources away from private sector activities, that can increase the price level. In general, if we look at the Inflation Reduction Act, what you have is a bill that has about $370 billion over the next 10 years of subsidies of various kinds for the energy industry. Some have called it a mini version of the Green New Deal. And then you also have about another $70 billion of Obamacare-related healthcare subsidies. So all in all, you're looking at over $400 billion in new government spending that is partly offset by new taxes on the private sector. But that also risks increasing prices for consumers, because what happens, of course, if you raise prices on manufacturers and other producers, those prices most likely get passed on to consumers because you've just increased the cost of production. So far from actually reducing inflation, I'd say that this is more like an inflation acceleration act. Now, there's a lot of components that go into when we see inflation. We've seen historical anomalies in terms of the supply shortages and the restrictions that were imposed during the pandemic. But we shouldn't think that because the government is spending money, that's going to reduce inflation. That's almost always going to increase inflation unless there are other offsetting factors.
Right now, the federal government is sitting at a debt to GDP ratio of about 100%. We're rounding, but Is there something magical about 100%?
It's the opposite of magical. It's actually quite troubling. What do we know about debt levels this high? There's been quite a bit of research done that shows that once a nation, including industrialized nations like the United States, hit debt levels of 90% of GDP and higher, you find that growth slows, because it's basically a signal that the size of government is approaching the size of the economy, and the government is consuming more resources in the economy that could otherwise go towards investment, productive research, and goods and services that are desired by the private sector. But instead, you have distortions. A lot of government spending ends up being wasted because you don't have the same incentives as in the private sector. Government spending isn't responsive to the needs of the public. It's more often politically directed. And that's why you tend to see growth slowing as the government consumes more resources out of the private sector. It's also deeply troubling because the last time the United States had a public debt level as a percentage of GDP at nearly 100% of its economy was immediately after World War II. And yes, we are coming out of a pandemic, but there was a lot of excessive spending that happened during the pandemic that wasn't directly related to fighting the virus, but was an opportunity again for politicians to abuse a crisis in order to increase spending on unrelated items. And the other deeply troubling fact is that we're not going to stop here. Actually, debt as a percentage of GDP is projected to sharply increase, more than doubling in the next 30 years. And that assumes very favorable assumptions, meaning no other pandemic, no major financial crises, no wars. So once you account for the potential of other political, economic, or geopolitical crises that we might face over that time period, it could go up by even more, and those would be completely historically unprecedented levels. And in the U.S. context, we're not sure what that would do, but it certainly increases the likelihood of a severe fiscal crisis that could undermine our economy, our prosperity, and also our geopolitical standing as a nation.
Last time I checked, several years ago, the U.S. spent about $250 billion a year annually servicing debt. And my assumption is that a small percentage increase caused by some sort of lack of confidence in the U.S. to pay its debts could dramatically increase that. What does that do to the federal budget? What does that do to the other priorities that the federal government has?
Yeah. Any dollar that we spend on interest on the debt is a dollar that is not available to, say, core federal priorities like national defense. So it is one way I like to look at the interest on the debt that we pay is basically we're paying for past sins because we overspend. We spent more than the federal government took in revenue, so went over budget. And the more we do that, the higher the debt gets. Even small changes in the interest rate, which are highly unpredictable, can cause massive increases in the cost of what the United States pays to service its debt. So that depends on the confidence that investors who buy U.S. Treasury bonds have in our country's ability to service that debt. Now, the United States is in an interesting position because we print our own money. So technically, we don't ever need to default on our debt because the United States can just print more money to serve its debt. But as you print more and more money, you also run the risk of severely increasing inflation and potentially getting into an inflationary death spiral where you have so-called hyperinflation that accelerates at a rapid, out-of-control pace. And in those scenarios, investors very much would expect that the value of every dollar that they receive in interest and also principal repayment, those dollars aren't going to be worth as much as when the United States first borrowed that money from those investors. And so you're basically defaulting by other means, by deflating the value of your currency. That can be very effective for countries, but it's also something that will not go on for long as investors catch on that that's what's going on. And then if they dump treasury bonds and don't buy anymore, you could find yourself in a situation where the U.S. dollar all of a sudden significantly depreciates and your currency becomes worthless. Now, that is a sort of worst case scenario, but it wouldn't be the first time for a nation to undermine its own prosperity because of bad financial practices. A very recent example, going back to World War II again, would be Britain. The UK was a major global superpower up until that war, and one of the ways that it undermined the pound's standing and value in the global marketplace was by spending too much on social programs. And that's exactly the situation we find ourselves in, where despite the recent spending bills, if you look at the CHIPS Act or now the Inflation Reduction Act or Inflation Acceleration Act, if we're specific here, the actual primary driver of spending and debt in the U.S. budget are the major entitlement programs. And that's where what nobody wants to talk about, because it's Social Security and it's Medicare, and those are on growing on autopilot. So politicians don't have to make any bipartisan deals. They can just do nothing, and those programs will drive us into ruin.
People refer to the spending that is done on entitlement programs as mandatory spending, which is a misnomer because they could cut that spending if they wanted to. There is no contractual or other requirement that individuals be paid the money that they have been promised. I put promised in air quotes because it is not genuinely a promise. Those programs can be reduced if Congress so decides. But like you said, they're on autopilot. They're politically a very troubling kind of promise to break. And you mentioned earlier that the debt level of debt that the United States will have projected to hold in the coming years is unprecedented. Well, as you sort of mentioned, as you alluded to, it's unprecedented for this country. It's not unprecedented for other countries that have suffered pretty terrible fates for having attempted to sustain this level of debt.
Yes, that's right. What we're looking at over the next 30 years is we assume that the Trump tax cuts will be allowed to expire. They're set to expire in 2025. We would still reach a publicly held debt level to GDP of 185%, so almost doubling from the current level. But then again, I don't think that it's politically realistic to assume those tax cuts, which are primarily for families and middle-class households, will be allowed to expire. That seems like a political football. We'll see what happens when we get to that point. But assuming those tax cuts get extended, we are looking at a publicly held debt level to GDP of 260%. It's a crazy number. There's one country that has debt levels this high that has been able to sustain them that we can look to as a potential case study for the future. And that is Japan, which has been at a debt level of 250% of GDP for quite some time. However, we differ from Japan in a significant way, which is that most of Japan's publicly held debt is held by its own public. So it is domestically held debt. In the United States context, we are looking at most of that debt being held in foreign markets. China and Japan are actually some of our largest debt holders. So that's a very different scenario than when it's basically your own population saving versus you're dependent and reliant on outside investors, which is the scenario we find ourselves in. So I don't think it's reasonable to assume that we could sustain a similar level of debt to GDP in Japan because we are dependent on those investors. Additionally, if you look at the Japanese economy, it's been stagnant for quite some time. And so you really see there the impact of this high debt and the decline in population leading to a country that's been stagnant and without growth, you basically your population living standards don't improve. Growth is also correlated with an increase in life expectancy and better health conditions. So you pay a very high price when you rack up debt that suppresses your economic growth in such a significant way. And again, I do worry that we would find ourselves in a very different situation if the U.S. debt were to go up to, you know, even just 200% of GDP, doubling from the current level, where I think investors would start disciplining the U.S. Congress in an attempt to ensure that they get the full value or close to the full value of what they loaned the government and not some deflated value. Because we're unable to manage our finances.
All is not lost, right?
Right.
I mean, there are things that with the right intestinal fortitude, Congress could do. But I just don't see that this problem of ever increasing amounts of debt and the political constituencies for the benefits that that debt is enabling. I just don't see a political appetite for doing it. So if Congress woke up tomorrow and decided this is our priority, dealing with this debt and trying to bring it back down to a more rational level, what would that look like?
So there have been various budget plans introduced, and the sooner you start chipping away at the debt, the more gradual the changes that you need to make. And that means that you impose less pain. People have more time to adapt to the new realities. For example, if you reduce Social Security benefits over the long run, people can substitute by saving more in private retirement accounts, which will grow with the market. And so they can then replace what they would have expected to receive from Social Security through their own private savings. But if you wait and you don't make those changes now, you could find yourself in a situation where much more drastic measures would be required that would have to be implemented fairly quickly. People wouldn't have time to prepare. They wouldn't have time to save and make other provisions accounting for those changes in policy. And so it becomes harder and harder the longer you wait. The issue we have is that, like you mentioned before, so-called mandatory spending, or rather autopilot spending, is that these programs increase automatically with changes in the cost of living, with the increase in the number of beneficiaries, and also, importantly, with the increase in life expectancy, which has been one of the primary cost drivers. So what you can do there is you could increase the retirement age, or the so-called eligibility age. You can means test benefits where you focus them on those individuals who need them the most, while wealthier individuals are expected to make ends meet with their own savings and investments. So you have ways of addressing this. I do think that what we need in this case is a lot more public education. I think Congress is going to lag behind the public on this. And lawmakers are also incredibly myopic, only thinking about the next election, their primary goal being to get reelected, not necessarily fix the country's financial situation, but there's definitely an attitude of kicking the can down the road and letting someone else deal with it. So I think that pressure will need to come from the outside as the American people understand just the severe consequences that we will face and the much more drastic policy changes that would be required that Congress might be forced into if outside investors lose confidence and stop buying all this debt that finances these entitlement programs, primarily Social Security and Medicare. Then I think we can get to a place where lawmakers might be able to come together and make those gradual changes sooner rather than later. But it doesn't help when you have these crony subsidy bills getting passed. This corporate welfare we saw both in the CHIPS Act and now with the so-called Inflation Reduction Act for the energy industry, that just sends the wrong signal, as if we had all this money to spend, that if you can spend money on cronies, it's going to be very hard to explain to the American people why you need to adjust their Medicare and Social Security benefits, even though in the big picture, the subsidies still are a small portion of the overall budget. It just sends the wrong signal politically, and it doesn't show any seriousness in terms of understanding the fiscal situation that we're in and the potential catastrophe that we're heading towards. So I'm afraid that we likely have delayed this issue even further. But as we see potential changes in Congress and the makeup of our political leaders, there might be another chance to correct things. But it's going to be difficult either way. But you have seen nations do it. You saw Sweden, which is considered a very progressive European nation, has a better, more balanced approach to its budget than we do. So we know that it's possible. And one of the things they did is change the default. So there aren't automatic increases in certain entitlement programs. Instead, they reflect the fiscal realities better and also the demographic realities of their population. So it's a conversation we need to have in the United States, and we should be having it soon because that just gives us a lot more option to deal with this problem.
Romina Baccia directs budget and entitlement policy at the Cato Institute. Please give a rating to the Cato Daily Podcast on your podcast platform of choice and follow us on Twitter @CatoPodcast.